Okay, we're back. Are we on? Yes, we're back. Welcome back to LA Lit with Nada Gordon. And we're going to jump back in with another reading. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about a political poem?
So that one's totally.
You're right.
Yeah.
And also, just because I'm in LA, Arnold is in this poem, so. Decency in the arts. My call to our fellow Americans is, while one person can't do everything, one person can do something to make our society a more compassionate and decent place. George W. Bush. Folly. Folly is speaking. Folly, by the way, is a goddess. And Erasmus's book, The Praise of Folly, is written, it's Folly praising herself. So anyway, Folly praises herself. Folly. Go, redolent Arnold, quit thy power, thy sex clubs, muscle boys, and plastic surgery, thy couch of many a thorn and flower, all these ex-Charlie's Angels, orgies, and coming out stories. Would you, could you learn to felch deceitful beauty's steely meaning? Do you guys know what felch means?
No.
To felch is to lick or suck the semen from your lover's anus. So, would you, could you learn to felch deceitful beauty's steely meaning? I continue spurting dingleberries, doilies at your feigned surprise, your roguish leer, your apple pie, till your love channel fills with cum and crudest oil. Such a tender beady eye, the thrilling occupation, that unregulated, stinky, hate-filled, loose cannon body, wheezing at that particular intersection of pussy and pinkness where I perform Condoleezza at 0 hour. Condoleezza, rimming rummy in waxen panties. We hear the voice of Liberace in the monster's head that flutters hence on wanton wing. Cheney's blatantly in chains, spurting black baby-making cream into wonks and loins that lave thee in its lucid spring, uranium depleted. You self-proclaimed fetal alcohol syndrome, take thy beverage from the ancient rose and ram it up your dirty bomb in order to slurp its eyeball with a straw and on John Ashcroft's breast repose. I am the spawn of Lucifer himself, swinging wild as a warlock in Levittown. No rapture swells the imperial voice, particularly the one with the floppy blonde hair. Still, I'm curious enough to want to tickle Star Sailor or that orange slut wearing that 70s pattern of the missing weapons of self-destruction, begging us to schmooze the cream out of her vast right-wing conspiracy. I also find that hot semen splashing against my prostate can trigger a deployment. To drink the spirit of the breeze, how many judges did Miss America have to crush? They wander midst o'er arching trees where they suck dildos or woo with undisturbed delight, Peggy Noonan spanking a slave in 9-inch heels. Meanwhile, the pale-cheeked virgin of the night, piercing through the leafy bower, primly dabs his lips with a napkin and splurches on the ground a silvery shower of little missiles. There ought to be limits to freedom, George W. Bush. Pillbox codpiece, lace scrotum. How much money would it take to felch the tapioca spilling out behind his beady eyes? $87 billion? Oh, rend my heart with every pain, but let me love again. And while you're at it, fix the fucking voting machines. Della Crusta.
Thank you. Well, we want to jump back in with a question about, I've been wanting to ask this, it's hard for me to put it into a short format, but throughout your work there's a sense of a very close attention to sound even down to the morphine unit.
Morphine unit, baby.
That was a nice
slip. Your poetry has morphine.
morphine. And I'm hoping to hear you talk about your sort of in a closely detailed way your experience of that and how it's related to like the bliss of writing.
Wow, what a great question. I guess it's blissful because it's in the body, and the body is really noisy. I don't like the body, and bodies are really noisy. You know, they vibrate. Sounds come out. Sound is like a kind of power. I feel very, when I'm happiest, I think I feel very connected to my body and to my vocal apparatus. And I think that the whole notion of vocal apparatus in poetry has been minimized or jettisoned. I don't want to say jettisoned, minimized in recent avant-gardes, with some really notable exceptions, but I think that as a young person around really rigorous cerebral language poets, that I felt like I wanted to stay connected to, you know, the diaphragm and all of the pipes that make this possible. But I think that maybe the bliss is also kind of related to infantile babble and the joy of that. And glossolalia. It's funny, my mother used to meditate in the other room, and I would hear her like going into glossolalia, and I always thought it was really weird. But at the same time, I knew that that was kind of the same thing that I want to sort of wallow in writing.
Yeah, I think English is rich language. I'm sure every language is rich, but being a native English speaker, I feel like we have a rich source, but also sometimes problematical too. Like sometimes English is uncomfortable.
But English is really expressive, and it requires some singing. I mean, I realize that. I'm an ESL teacher, and I always have to tell students who don't speak stress-timed languages that speaking English needs to be a completely different vocal experience and has to be scored really in a different way. And I think that it enriches our poetry a lot.
And you lived in Japan for quite a while, and a lot of Japanese comes into your work. Can you talk about, I mean, how, I don't know if you learned Japanese before going to Japan or learned it there, but can you talk about how that other language has also influenced kind of like your use of English?
Well, I think I could count to 10 and ask where the toilet was when I went to Japan. So, I think that the influence of the Japanese language on the book Foreign Body is really clear and intense. Yeah. I don't know that I see it so much on the rest of my work. I mean, I think that really what's been more important is the influence of thinking of my language as a strange thing that needs to be taught as an object and deconstructed, either to be understood or to be deliberately misunderstood. you know, whether I'm thinking about pedagogy or art, but the influence of the Japanese language. I don't know, I was there for 11 years. It really became a part of my body and my head. And I think that my tendency to speak a little haltingly, which you can hear, probably is related to that, to having been there for so long and communicating with people in sort of this shadow language.
Well, we're going to open up the floor to questions from the audience. And I just have to turn on these microphones that are sitting right here. And you don't have to go up to either of them. You can just speak.
But oh, that's cool.
Let me turn them on.
I remember when Ellie let you have to get up and speak on the microphone.
Yeah. The technology has really taken us places in this basement. So, if anybody has any questions for Nada?
Nada. Mm-hmm. Will you talk more about when you were talking about this politics? I hate to open up the politics of ornamentation or that. Can you elaborate on that more?
What do you want to know about it?
I don't know. Whatever you want to say.
Well, I have a specific question about that. Okay. You said that you think of ornamentation as political and as inclusive. And I was curious about what specifically about ornamentation links to inclusivity for you, and maybe that will lead into Carol's question.
I guess I think of like rectilinearity and blank spaces as being really, really male and very uninclusive. You know, I think of Shakespeare, like all of those parts of Shakespeare where he's deriding women for being ornamental or painted. And, you know, that just that dichotomy that has run through Western culture. That even, you know, otherizes cultures that it deems overly colorful. Or there's a wonderful book called, God, what is it called? Chromophobia by David Batchelor. And it's it delves into this notion in a wonderful way. So I guess I feel like that. I think Stan Apps actually pointed that out to me about my work. I didn't realize that I was being democratic and pluralistic in having all of these elements. But I think that he's right in a way, although, I mean, it's probably not my intention, my conscious intention, but I think that is what happens, you know. Like,
yeah, I mean, Steph and I were talking before, like earlier today, about specifically, you know, Stan's review of Folly and this kind of idea of poetry becoming more democratic, and what would that mean? Does it relate? Are there other ways besides ornamentation, do you think, that your work becomes more inclusive?
Yeah, I think it's not a particularly new tactic, but you know, high and low, it's all in there. Uh-huh. It's the good old camp formula. And I love it. I'm there. I don't know if that. I don't know if that. I mean, I.
No, it's good.
I'm pretty aware that my work is not really political in any kind of recognizable way, and yet I feel like there is some kind of activist urge there. But I'm not. I don't know that I'm even sure what it's being activist about. It's just a revolutionary impulse.
I was interested in that concept, and I think you explained it more.
So you had some question about, was it the same thing?
I just asked it about.
Oh, you did?
And orientation.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I had another question, but I also
didn't have a question. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've got a set of curiosity. The poem that I hate poem. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that I hate the World Cup. Is that rugby or football?
Well, I think that I think that poem is one of the most purely heteroglossic of. I mean, I don't know if it, is it a poem or is it like, is it a museum? I almost think it's a museum of people's utterances, and you know, each sort of stanza is like an exhibit in the museum with a light shining on it saying, look at this, you know, look at what's happening here. So I do hate all sports, but it has nothing, but my personal feeling about the World Cup, and I really have none, is not in that poem at all.
I was curious, did you describe that poem as offensive?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could speak to the distinction between this is an offensive poem and there are many people in the world hold offensive views, and this poem is going to address some of those.
Well, I think that the latter is a really apt description of what that poem does.
Yeah,
but I think that people assume that it's always the poet speaking, and don't even want to posit any kind of dramatic role or roles that a poet speaker can take on. And this has very much to do with a really limited notion of what lyric is. I still feel like it's lyric, it's just not necessarily mine.
Would you be willing to just kind of dip back into Folly really quickly and read the kind of other side of the I Hate Women poem, the I Love Men poem?
Okay.
Would you mind?
No. Although I usually stand up and do silly movements when I do this poem, but that's okay. No, it's okay.
I'm so disappointed.
Nah.
I can totally move. I can change
it's actually,
the microphone really
it's
quickly.
Actually, it's actually, you can see it on YouTube.
Oh.
Oh my God.
I think YouTube is the site of the sacred now.
Yes.
It's actually voiced in lots of different names of Victorian fetishists, and they were part of the list that I read before. But I'm not going to actually say the voices. I'm just going to read what they're saying. And the poem is called I Love Men. I wrote the meanest, silliest thing below about men. I'm so sorry. Please ignore. Anyway, here's why I love men. They are brave. I love men's thighs, their hands, the small of their necks. I love men. But more than the physicality of it all, I love that men are freaks, born. I love men, and that's why it bothers me. No, infuriates would be a better word. I love men for their strength. Sometimes it is that vein that bulges on the upper part. I love men for the way they give up everything but themselves for love. I love men with big penis, and I love men's hair. Everything about men's hair is a wonder to me. I love men who come to me once every 2 months with thick, dark hair in their nostril. I love men. I love mean ones and nice ones and fat ones and skinny ones, but most of all, I love super hot ones. The sensation of poo in my mouth. I love to hang out with my friends and go to parties. I like a lot of sequins of clothing. I love men with good personality. I love men in cycling shorts. I love men in kilts. I love men with long legs. I love men who are pigeon-toed. I just love men. I love stripping men naked with just my eyes. It's something that I want all the time now, and I mean all the time. I love men who are slightly cocky and arrogant, something sexy there. I love men with top hats and beautifully tailored tuxedos and immaculately polished shoes. I love men in uniform. I love firemen. I love men in turbans. I love men who wear fishnets and skirts. It's just downright sexy. I love men staring from buses in the next lane. Sometimes my boyfriend will make me go out in a miniskirt without panties to go on an escalator. I love men in boots. That's a whole lot of boots. I love men, but they wear me out with all their confusing issues. One day they say they love you, and the next day they see someone with a bigger ass. I love men, muscles, sex, porn, and chocolate. I love men on Prozac. I love men on Prozac with their calm James Dean smiles and dreamy novelist eyes. Of course, I love men of all races, but I have to admit I'm completely fascinated by Asian men. Japanese, Chinese, Korean, I love it all. I love men. They're energetic, great at fetching, and I love them. Darlings, I love men, especially when they are silent, beautiful, and have no panties. I love wieners and jewels. I love men, money, power, and I love my sex. Me and my sex, and I love my sex. Only me and my sex. La 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 la. I love men even though they're lying, cheating scumbags. I love men not for what unites them, but for what divides them, and I want to know, most of all, what gnaws at their hearts. I love men. I love men. I love men. I love men. I love men.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I thought you did that one
really
personally.
No. It's just a good reading. You gotta take this stuff to heart, I guess. So then my question would be automatic, you know, just kind of obvious, like, how do you think that piece differs from the I Hate Women piece, if at all? It's an obvious question.
I Love Men doesn't feel to me to be problematic. I Hate Women is problematic.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in that problem. I think that's the central problem of FLARF, and the problem that you know, we wrestle with when satire gets really uncomfortable. You know, Throw the Jew Down the Well, that Borat song, is something I really can't stop thinking about. I can't, you know, and I think there's something, V imp, you know, obviously that means very important, right? But it also means, like, I'm really kind of attached to that imp. I'm really attached to this image of this sort of little demon, this little demon of writing that you know, wants to, like, scratch something until it's really annoying. You know, I'm really interested in that annoyingness. And I think that I Hate Men is an extremely annoying poem.
It's I Hate Women, actually. You said I. You, it's funny.
Oh, well,
you
that too.
Said,
yeah.
Have you done a version I Hate Men where because I think, like, culturally in our society, it is, on the whole, permissible for men to say incredibly nasty things about women, and everybody's meant to sort of drop their PC still and go, oh, you know, just, you know, we'll suspend that in the name of humor. But if it goes the other way around, if women slag off men.
Well, I think that'd be a really interesting Google experiment. And I'm sure that the women out there are extremely vicious and very interesting. So I haven't, no. Although, Noah Eli Gordon wrote an I Love Women poem in response to my I Love Men poem. That was great. So that's been done. That territory has been covered.
Oh, yes, I'm interested in the I hate men version.
Right, no, I know. Yeah. I know. So there's still one part of the quadrant that we need to fill.
Can I just say, I like in the I Hate Women poem, when they're talking about, like, the little museum things, and knowing that they're Google lines, like the way that the refrain comes back and like how it's different every time. Mm-hmm. Like every time it's different, it's heartbreaking. Like every time,
yeah.
Like it's heartbreaking, like this heartbreaking thing. That's kind of amazing. Thing, different.
So is heartbreaking good? I mean, is that something that you want when you read a poem?
Well, it's not what I want, it's what I get. You know? It's, I mean, it's fine. You know?
Uh-huh.
You said something about how you're interested in the way in which flarf, but maybe not just flarf, but poetry becomes problematic, that where satire
mm-hmm.
actually really makes you feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And since we were talking about a sort of politics of ornament before, I mean, for me, that moment when satire becomes like really actually uncomfortable, do you see that as political in your work or in Flarf as well? I mean,
yeah,
is that?
I think it tells a kind of truth, and tells it really baldly, and you know, evokes sensation, heartbreak, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
And would you? I mean, is that? Because you said at some point there's this level of activism in your work, but then it's maybe not. It seemed like you were not sure exactly what activist is for.
Well, because it's not clear. I mean, I'm obviously
yeah.
not Carolyn Forché, you know
yeah.
what I mean? I'm
yeah.
like really, really far from that kind of... But I feel like... I guess there is a kind of defeatism that sort of pervades my thinking, which is... Human beings are never going to overcome this folly. You know, we start if we manage to end this war, they'll
yeah.
start another one. You know,
yeah.
there are, which is not to say that we shouldn't, but I think that we're a deeply, deeply flawed, pathetic, and entertaining species. And I do what I can with that fact. You know.
Yeah.
Kind of bad politics, I know, but. I kind of want to be reformed, so if anybody wants to, like... I mean, I... Yeah.
Well, I think... Well, I
Yeah, no, what?
I mean,
Stephanie,
I guess I just
me.
Think, like... I mean, we take a lot of responsibility for what we do without realizing that whatever we do, we're still nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've been reading The Botany of Desire, and in the introduction, the author... talks about, you know, how unconsciously we would behave, even though we think we know what we're doing, we hate the war, we love the war, whatever, we know. But, I mean, who knows what other mechanisms are at work? I mean, if you look at how ants operate, I mean, there's like a lot of affinity there. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree kind of feeling, like, you know, the insects were here millions of years, and here come humans, and it's like, you know, the behaviors aren't that different. So,
I mean, I have this line, you know, and it's not a Googled line, obviously, that I like a little loot. What is it? I like a little... Oh, I can't remember my damn line. It's something like, I like a little lute to fiddle, but it's not that. But I like a little lute to something while the world's ending. And, you know, that's the claim that I make for my poetry. That's kind of it.
Yeah, there is that feeling of the orchestra playing while the ship is sinking.
Yeah.
Feeling with
yeah.
your work that's
yes,
nice.
It feels very fin de monde. Sorry, everybody.
So, any other questions from the audience?
I'd like to ask about the musicality and your singing of your poems, and that, you know, this sort of what the relationship is in terms of the written printed text and your performance of it, and whether the song exists as you're writing it, like before the text exists, or if it comes afterwards, or where you
texts have to be really manipulated to be turned into. Proper songs like the one that I sang at the beginning. That is a tune that I have on a CD of Italian love song sung by, help me, what's her name? Cecilia Bartoli. Does that sound right? Is that it? Yeah. And so I love to steal things. So I stole that melody and I put my poem, which was like one of those poems that you write when you just wake up. So I think that poem is really interesting because it's just logical impossibility after logical impossibility, and it seemed to kind of ask for a melody. But I don't know. I mean, I'd love to be at a point where everything was sung, but it's really labor intensive.
So you don't do the other thing where you have something that you wrote that later you choose to sing?
Or? No, I do sometimes. Yeah, but I mean, the problem is like with the Benshi you saw earlier.
Yeah.
That's I have to do more sort of recitative. It's a different style than actually having a melody and singing it.
Do you ever hear a melody in your head and then write the words to it?
Yeah, but they tend to be sort of a little drony because the melodies that I think of by myself are not very sophisticated, but the melodies that I steal are. So,
wire palette, perhaps.
Yeah, but there's often like a melody that I want to appropriate and match something to.
Well, should we finish with a reading?
Okay.
Do you have one? Yeah?
I'm wondering if I have another song. Seems like that would be nice to end on a song, but let me think if I have one that's actually ready. Can you edit out this space?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. Silence is nice, though.
Okay, you know what? I'm gonna read a new play. And two short poems, that's what I'm gonna read.
And I'm not gonna do a song. Oh, this is perfect. I totally forgot about this. So this is not a song, but it harkens back to the destruction of poetry. So the poem is called Poetry. I too dislike it, although there are things I dislike even more. Toe rings, avocado, gold jewelry, sweetened muesli, tattoos, the smell of fairy liquid, fat men with long hair, merengue, yellow snow or dirty snow, airline food, Tiger Woods, the US Postal Service, Giuliani, fundamentalists, haircuts, baby clothes, creepy eyes, wine. I dislike that Elvis never bought me a Cadillac. I dislike using upscale to describe something because it is a lazy way of describing something, even this upscale poem. And I dislike most of all having found, without even looking for it, its giant eye, a milky, unseeing orb, and little winglets, spikes of feathers just poking through the creamy down, the little fledgling, dead as poetry, on the sun-drenched deck outside my writing room. Now, you know this is fictional because I live in a Brooklyn apartment. There ain't no sun-drenched deck. Finding it, however, and with a perfect contempt for it, I discovered in it, after all, a place for the poem to become aggressive. I grasped it with my left hand and squoze until those unseeing eyes popped out of their sockets and minuscule feathers came out on my palm, mingling with its sparrow blood. This experience is important, not because a high-sounding interpretation can be put on it, but because I am rolling and rolling in a field of bourgeois self-esteem, laughing in the sunlight, ha ha ha, caring not that my Eileen Fisher linen tunic gets as wrinkled as a newborn babe. I am comfortable. I love my life. The same thing may be said for all of us, that we don't mind holding on upside down to a dead baby bird, a nuthatch, perhaps, that is perched inside one's urethra, like elephants pushing into a weak vulva or a wild horse learning how to sing. The skin of the poem twitches like a horse, insolent and trivial, like imaginary magazines with real toadies in them. I've talked, typed, whatever, what I like, read stuff, food, making stuff, sugar, the odd spot of funk dancing, but ah, poetry. For all its rawness, I still dislike it. The fledglings leap, tiny suicide bombers, into the great maw of benozic night. And this is appropriated from students' writing. She had a task to do a transcription of something she'd heard online, and she came up with what to me was an just amazing poem, so I'm gonna end with that. Like a gypsy in the cotton, explain how the animator is fixed our turn I cup. Where they lived, there's are a table, pie, no chow chi, there is means a chair. And I saw the movies, and a few days ago, noticed that their selves behind eating are examples, an enthusiast China rattle ride myth century modernist designers are fairly bred birds, quite the design in the ast, certainly. Your doctors must suit turkeys, but I finally created. He just study material that middle of disappear everything, she does. Your suit can be scratched to hard. You can engineering yourself and security rain shape, actually undetectable, get to greasy like a gypsy in the cotton. That things would be push the buttons and anything happens. So, it has a thing that senses just being at all of made wonderland. Honey, what? Where is my super suits?